Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, sitting in for Chris Boyd. From the outside, Marilyn Monroe appeared to be a blonde Hollywood goddess, almost mythical.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Mr. President.
That's her singing Happy Birthday, Mr. President in 1962, just 3 months before she committed suicide. My guest writes that Monroe likely had borderline personality disorder, and she's far from the only famous person with a serious mental health issue. Andy Warhol, Howard Hughes, Albert Einstein, Claudia Kalb diagnoses them all with a little help from psychiatrists in her book, Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder, Inside the Minds of History's Great Personalities. Claudia, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So after I read your book, I realized that Marilyn Monroe was really not who I thought she was. She was much more than just a Hollywood starlet.
Definitely. And that was the direct impression I got after researching her. I really knew her as most of us do, that sort of platinum hair and the look she had when she sang to JFK and her sequin dress. I mean, it was such a drama and a beautiful whole just aesthetic look to her. But beneath that, she was really struggling. She was a woman who had a very difficult childhood. She was born to a mom who couldn't care for her, who gave her up just within a couple of weeks of her birth, and she really searched and went on a quest throughout her life for some love, for a sense of security, for family, for an identity, and it sort of haunted her, and it was just really revealing. I had no idea. She was so troubled.
Yeah, so her childhood was pretty rough, you mentioned, and her mom had a mental health issue as well, right?
Right. So when she was about seven, her mom actually got her back from the foster family for a little while, and she lived with her. But at some point, she heard screams and shouting. Her mom was coming down the steps and essentially being taken off to a mental institution. And she was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia at the time. And really, she didn't know her mom after that. She never knew her father. I mean, she didn't have that sense of love. And she had mental illness in the family, which she actually worried about and wondered about and wondered whether it might affect her.
So when did she realize that she had a problem?
I think it was probably, it's hard to say precisely, but it seemed like she was on this quest from an early age to figure out who she was. And in a way, landing on stage was a place where she found some sense of security. It was sort of a foundation for her, but off stage, there was nothing. The ground would sort of, almost as if it would sink beneath her as she tried to find some sense of security. She died so young at 36, so she was in her 20s. She was married very early, seeking some sense of somebody in a way to save her. I think she was 16 when she married first. She married three times. From her first husband was a merchant marine. Her second was Joe DiMaggio, which the baseball player didn't last very long at all, and then Arthur Miller. And she never found anybody to kind of save her. And she sought help, but it didn't help her.
So you knew from research that she was in therapy and that she had been prescribed medication, but did you know her actual diagnosis?
No, it was very hard to confirm exactly what anybody did diagnose her with, but she did see prominent psychoanalysts of the day, and she did have a lot of interaction with one of them, specifically Dr. Greenson, and he, in a way, was trying to make up for the lack of family. But when you look back at it now, he stepped over the bounds of what a normal therapist-patient relationship. She came into the house. She became part of the family. She washed the dishes and ate dinner with the family. It was a really kind of a grasping for trying to help her, but it really didn't work. And the medications that she got prescribed by other doctors as well eventually did her in.
So how did you come to the conclusion that she likely had borderline personality disorder and describe what that disorder is?
Right. Well, borderline is it's a difficult disorder. It's one of a number of personality disorders that are pretty entrenched in a person, and they come with all sorts of symptoms. Like, in borderline comes with this, I think I mentioned, sort of a confused identity, this emotional volatility. You have unstable relationships, and you're very impulsive. Now, I found out about Monroe and this link to borderline by reading medical reports, and it came up in a number of medical papers that her name would come up as Marilyn Monroe was sort of this, her symptoms just look like classic borderline personality disorder. So I interviewed those experts to try to find out more. And it seemed that in her case, the lineup was almost just so consistent that it made sense that that's what she had. And what's so striking is that there are much better therapy approaches today. And I asked one of the experts, could she have been saved? Were she alive today? And he said, yes.
Wow. So what, I mean, she was doing sort of the typical of that time psychoanalysis, talking a lot about your childhood and so on, I imagine. But what would she might have received in terms of treatment today?
Right. So exactly. She was doing a lot of that kind of being inside the difficult stuff and talking through the past. That's what would have happened in psychoanalysis. Today, their approaches, one of them is called dialectical behavior therapy, and there are others that sort of are in that same category where they acknowledge the traumatic past, because a lot of times it does stem or can be influenced by a difficult childhood. There's an acknowledgement of that, but there's a balance between accepting and then changing. And so there are skills that patients learn, coping mechanisms, ways to regulate emotions. And so they're given a structure in terms of moving forward. And she never had access to that at all.
Okay, so when I was reading this book, I couldn't help but sort of start to self-diagnose as well. And, you know, I used to obsessively avoid cracks in the sidewalk. I know other people did too. And you say you've been known to triple check the stove before leaving the house. So where is the line between, I guess, what we think of as normal behavior and a psychological problem?
Right, and that is such a critical question. So essentially one of the, first of all, let's say that all of these conditions exist on a spectrum or a continuum. So we can all have elements, let's say, of OCD, where you do that. You step over the cracks and you check the stove and you make sure the door is locked. Maybe you do it two or three times. Maybe, you know, you think about it a lot more than you wish you did. But in terms of an actual diagnosis, there are clusters of symptoms that you would look at for any of these conditions when you're talking about anything from depression to OCD to anxiety. But also, does the condition affect your life in a way where you are not able to be really functional? So is it inhibiting your life in some way? Is it getting in the way of living a productive life? And that's one of the ways you would assess where the line is crossed.
So, and that comes up, you write about Howard Hughes, and he was actually, I didn't realize, born in Texas as well, and died in Texas too. But he had pretty severe OCD. And for anyone who's seen the movie The Aviator, where Leonardo DiCaprio plays him, they might remember he had this obsession with cleanliness. But it went really far. Describe his symptoms.
He was really remarkable in how, you know, and how difficult his life became with his OCD. So he started having symptoms sort of in his early 20s or so. And he was a psychologist who looked back at his life said, you know, it started then when he started gargling a lot and he started avoiding people with colds. There was a lot of worry about germs and cleanliness. And this is a classic with OCD. And as he was working in the film industry and he was working very hard and he had sort of a control that needed. He was constantly trying to control everything and driving people crazy because he wanted sort of perfect circumstances. And when he couldn't get them, he moved. He wanted more clouds in the sky, for example, during one shoot. And he moved everybody from Southern California to Northern California to get the sky to look right, you know. So he was demanding. And then he started repeating sentences. And that's a symptom of OCD. His condition got so bad, his fear of germs, his desire for repetition and sort of things done in a certain way, that he had memos he would write up where he would give, you know, lessons about if you're going to open the medicine cabinet, you need 15 Kleenexes minimum to open the door of the cabinet. He sealed windows with masking tape. He had a memo about how to clean a can of fruit before you open it and how to hand it to me. It had to be, you know, the label had to be removed and the soap can washed with a sterile brush. And here's how you make a grilled cheese sandwich. And he eventually just isolated himself and could not function. I mean, he was so overwhelmed by these intrusive thoughts and this cleanliness, this fear of germs, that it really did him in.
It's so sad. How has the diagnosis of mental illness evolved over time? And for example, with Howard Hughes, was he diagnosed with OCD?
There's no evidence he was diagnosed. And at the time, it would have been called something slightly different. They had some certain awareness that people had these kinds of obsessions and compulsions, and there was an awareness this had been around for a very long time. But how to treat it, how to diagnose it and understand it, you know, it's really only in the last number of years, let's say 60, you know, years or so, where you have psychiatrists coming together and creating a manual of mental illness, which looks at each one of these different conditions and comes up with a list of symptoms. So deciding what somebody has, going through a diagnosis and a treatment is sort of a, you know, current day thing in terms of the way psychiatrists view mental health. It's, you know, it's been treated in so many ways from hundreds of years back, when they used to drill holes in people's heads to get, you know, to excise the demons out. And you know, President Lincoln, who suffered from depression, was trying mercury. It came in pills called Blue Mass, and he was trying to do that. I mean, there were spas, you know, different ways to try to treat electroshock therapy, all sorts of different approaches. And then ultimately, when medications became available in the last number of decades, that there's been a, you know, looking at those to help in certain kinds of mental health conditions. And there are lots of questions, really, even now, because medicine has risks and benefits. So what is the best way to treat? And I think there's still a lot to learn. I think one of the most interesting lessons to come out of my research was that the brain is just, we know this, but it's so infinitely complex. And trying to understand it and pinpoint mental health conditions in the brain is a really daunting task.
Yeah.
There's so much work to do.
Was it tricky to get psychiatrists to diagnose people who are famous and who are dead?
Right. So psychiatrists are wary of doing that. They definitely do not want to diagnose people that aren't sitting in front of them in their clinic.
Yeah.
On the other hand, and that's true of most of them, but there are people, psychiatrists, who are not only willing to entertain the notion that somebody's characteristics might line up with some disorder, but, you know, have done it in books and medical studies. I really looked hard and found a lot of those where they were trained experts looking at famous people. And, you know, part of the reason for doing that is understanding the evolution of mental health, is understanding how things have changed, better understanding these people, chipping away at stigma. So there's some people who will not go there at all. And what I relied on, the people that had studied famous figures, all of them dead. I mean, none of these people are alive today. And just trying to assess what was going on in their minds.
Fascinating. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman in for Chris Boyd. This hour, writer Claudia Kalb is talking about her new book, Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder, Inside the Minds of History's Great Personalities. She'll be in Dallas at the Adolphus Hotel for a luncheon on Thursday, May 12th. You can join our conversation now by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Margie Evans, nationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking with author Claudia Kalb. She's author of the new book, Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder, Inside the Minds of History's Great Personalities. We talk about how fame can rip a person apart and about the enormous stress of being in the spotlight. And I think few people better illustrate that point than Princess Diana. So how did she go, Claudia, from that fairy tale wedding at the age of 19 to cutting herself and full-blown bulimia years later?
Right. So Diana, it's such a tragic story. And you really have to back up in a way to go back to her childhood. And childhood becomes a theme in a lot of these stories. And in hers, she described her childhood as unhappy. She came from parents. She was a child of divorce. They were six when she was divorced, and she remembered crying in bed and not being able to comfort her younger brother. And she grew up feeling torn, and it was difficult. She had not a lot of self-esteem. She struggled academically. And so she got to the point where she was now such a young woman getting married when she was just, I think she was 19, and her to-be husband was 32, and she's entering into this palace life. And it really did look like a fairy tale when we all watched her walk down the aisle in 1981. But the reality was she was going into a place that she found little comfort, little support. It was a cold place, she described it. And not to mention, there was Camilla Parker Bowles, the other woman, in the sidelines from the very beginning. So she did not feel comfortable in this marriage from the start. And she talked about, even before she walked down the aisle, this bulimia starting, that she was that you eat too much and then you purge it. And in a way, it's a way of sort of getting out that pain. And she started described it on the honeymoon, that she was binging and purging on the honeymoon. It was a way to release tension. But she was so emotionally troubled and so under so much stress and just didn't feel like she was getting the help and support. And certainly her husband, she felt, wasn't committed to the marriage.
And there's an interview that she did in 1995. Princess Diana told BBC reporter Martin Bashir this.
And it's a repetitive pattern, which is very destructive to yourself. It was a symptom of what was going on in my marriage. I was crying out for help, but giving the wrong signals. And people were using my bulimia as a coat on a hanger. They decided that was the problem. Diana was unstable.
Instead of looking behind the symptom at the cause.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's powerful to hear her looking back on that. And we think of eating disorders as something that's inextricably linked with our culture's obsession with thinness. But is that what it's always about for eating disorders?
Well, if you think about it, I mean, I think that there is an obsession for sure. We know that we see advertisements and young girls are being influenced to some degree by these very skinny models. And it's a problem that we're saturated with that kind of, this is what you're supposed to look like. And young girls try to live up to that. But then again, there are a lot of people who are not affected by eating disorders. So it's not a direct cause. I think they're studying this to find out. There's a lot of gene studies going on to see how much genes contribute to eating disorders. What's going on in the brain that would contribute to somebody's, you know, impulsive need to do this? And there's a lot of science that's being studied so that treatment can improve for people. I don't think in so many of these mental health conditions, it's such a combination, such a tangle of factors that would be partially genetic and partially environmental, and partially just who you are, how your brain works. It's really hard to tease it out, and there's a lot of crossover, so it becomes hard to specifically diagnose and hard to treat. But in her case, it's clearly bulimia. She talked about her bulimia. And interestingly, her public announcement about her bulimia and her talking about it really raised awareness. And I found it so interesting in a study. They looked and found that cases of bulimia went up dramatically after she went public and then dropped after her death. So she really did have an impact on people's awareness and
went up,
search.
You mean she didn't make people or inspire
right.
people to do
no.
this? It was them reporting it?
Yeah, sorry, that the numbers of cases reported or diagnosed, those numbers went up. So that meant more people were coming in to seek treatment, not that the cases increased just because there were more cases. Just that there was more awareness, more people came in for help.
Well, in the past few years, it's become really much more common for celebrities to reveal their own struggles with mental health. And the actress Emma Stone, I know she's talked about childhood panic attacks, and Demi Lovato also about bipolar disorder and depression. So what happens when famous people reveal what's going on behind the curtains, so to speak? What impact does that have?
I think it has a huge impact in terms of people's better understanding, better having more empathy, connecting with people and maybe helping the people around them and ideally getting rid of some of that stigma because it exists still in such a big way. If people don't talk about mental health conditions, then it becomes this other. It becomes this scary thing. And mental illness can be such a scary word. And a lot of these conditions are, as I mentioned earlier, there's this continuum. You can suffer from depression or anxiety. You can get help and you can function very well. So you can be mentally healthy by getting the help you need. So I think by these public figures speaking out are doing a big service because there have been a lot of studies in public health about how famous people affect awareness and people going to get help in any number of conditions, including something like diabetes. And it shows that there is an effect. It does help. And it really can help just open a conversation ultimately, which is so important.
And yet I remember in reading your book, you write that before Princess Diana went public about her cutting herself and the bulimia, one of the reasons she actually went and got treatment was because they threatened to out her.
That is so true. She did. A good friend said, "You need to do it. You need to get help or I'm going to out you." And, that's right. I mean, that probably isn't the ideal way to go about getting someone to come forward. It sort of evolved with her. I mean, what she did was she then went and sought help and she got help that she needed. And, her willingness to come out and talk about all sorts of things and tell secrets, was pretty remarkable. And I think it ultimately took away a lot of that mystery about what goes on in the palace and what was going on with her.
So let's talk a little bit about another famous person who you profile in this book. Let's talk about pop artist Andy Warhol. And you write that for him, more was always better. And it's funny how after you pointed that out, that he had this addiction to buying more and more stuff, and his art, which is often in these big series, it somehow seemed to make more sense to me.
That's great, because it did to me, too. I hadn't really not thought about that. I was researching him for hoarding disorder, and I started looking at those, classic silk screens of multiple things, hundreds of Coke cans and all those Campbell's soup cans and, Marilyn Monroe multiple times over and over. And it just seemed so odd. Why would you do that? And in a way, you can analyze it from an artistic perspective or from, it's all commodification of the culture and our obsession with stuff. But he seemed to really feel comfortable with excess. So there it was in the artwork. There it was in these boxes, his time capsules. There were 600 some time capsules that he just filled with everything from empty toothbrush boxes to prescription bottles. There was silverware he swiped from the Concorde, the old airline, old receipts and checks and stuff falling apart, and just could not help himself from just piling stuff into these boxes. And also his home cluttered with stuff. You couldn't walk through the dining room. And then he even collected, as I observed this tendency, I realized he collected people. He would go on his jaunts to the, to the clubs with a sort of horde of people coming with him. And he also recorded thousands of hours of just everyday routine conversations that he collected. There's, I think, 4,000-some hours of audio tapes of his conversations at the Warhol Museum.
And yet hoarding is at least a new diagnosis, right?
Right. So hoarding disorder used to be considered kind of a symptom or a category of OCD, in fact. But as researchers started studying it in depth, realized there's some differences and that people with OCD really hate their obsessions. It drives them crazy. But a lot of people with hoarding really like the process of accumulating and shopping. And Warhol was a mad shopper. I mean, he loved to go everywhere from the Five and Dime in New York City to the high-end galleries. But now it is its own hoarding disorder, and it's a separate and distinct diagnosis.
And yet, I mean, I feel like these days we sort of use that term hoarding and you're a hoarder really off the cuff, and we use it to talk about people who pile up magazines on their coffee table. But it can be serious, right?
Right. And it's another case where does it interfere with a person's life? And everybody has seen those images on cable
yes.
TV of those reality. And it's really daunting. You see those people just inside these houses where just clutter everywhere. And it becomes very, very painful to watch. And with Warhol, it was sort of, I mean, a high-end version of that. But he did in his statements about things, he had some classic feelings that are definitely line up with hoarding disorder. So he said he couldn't get rid of stuff. He had this inability to get rid of stuff. And that's a classic characteristic. And he said, "I'm so sick of the way I live." And this is really a quote from him: "All this junk, always dragging more home." And he said, "White walls and a clean floor, that's all I want." So he really had this desire not to do what his behavior was having him do, but he just could not help himself.
So also in your book, you write about Albert Einstein. And I would say, you know, there have been probably few brains more scrutinized than Einstein's. But you point out he probably had a mental health issue.
Well, with Einstein, so interesting. So here's a case where you wonder what would happen to him if he were alive today. This is, I think, the question with him, because he, as a child, he was a late talker. He had a repetitive kind of habit of repeating sentences, but he didn't talk until he was about three. Hmm. His parents were worried about that. They took him to the doctor. He was kind of socially isolated. He would be very, very focused on a single task, like his sister recalled he could build a stack of cards 14 stories high. He had this power of concentration, but also this withdrawal from what was going on around him. And the condition that comes up with Einstein is Asperger's, what used to be called Asperger's. It's now been folded into autism spectrum disorder, the bigger umbrella condition. But that where he was obviously a genius, he was fully functional in terms of what he did, but he had characteristics even throughout life where his social interactions were sometimes rocky. His relationships were troubled. He didn't always say the socially appropriate thing. He had trouble. He had trouble in school. He had trouble as a kind of a disorganized teacher. He kind of needed to be taken care of in terms of just everyday kind of stuff. His head and his brain obviously were beyond the rest of us, but otherwise, he had some issues. And so did he have something like autism spectrum disorder? Impossible to know. But if he were a child, would he have been kind of red flagged and assessed? I think probably he would have been looked at, especially given the talking issues and the sort of isolation.
Yeah, it was. I couldn't believe that reading about his childhood in your book in Germany, the family maid called him the dopey one, and street kids called him the boar.
Right.
So it's so hard to imagine that, but I guess it makes sense. And then you see the iconic image of Einstein and this sort of disheveled professorial look that he had. When you say he had to be taken care of, what do you mean?
Well, there was a great article written by an artist who went to do a portrait of him and noticed, and this was, I think, in the 1920s, and described him as being just kind of, he was wrinkled, looking, had no socks on. His wife, Elsa, was mothering him, and she had to help fix his hair. And the artist described Einstein as being so preoccupied in his thoughts. It was sort of abnormal. It was almost as if he couldn't interact with him. Einstein was just in his head. He disappeared into his own world, and this was something people would say about him and describe. And so he just had this ability, which I think in this case, you know, probably helped him to achieve his great thinking, but at the same time was at times difficult for the people around him. Also, in terms of helping, he was, when he was at Princeton later in life, they kind of had to guide him home sometimes. He'd get lost on the way home from the office to the house. And so
he was thinking of universal maps across the solar system. So, but I did notice also, you write that his, or I think I saw this actually online, that his son Edward had a mental illness, had schizophrenia.
Right. So that schizophrenia, and, you know, there's questions obviously about how all these genes work and what might have been going on with, you know, Einstein with the son. I mean, there is this interesting theory that put forth by a London Asperger's expert, Simon Baron Cohen, who has looked at, is there some link between the scientific mind and Asperger's? And even Hans Asperger, who was the man who first described the condition, connected in some way the scientific sort of brilliant mind with this difficult social traits, these the kind of schleppy look to them, you know, didn't care about the appearance of, because it was all inside the head.
Huh. But public perception of autism has really changed, I mean, in the past decade even.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some really interesting things going on there, even within the community itself, so that people who fall into the what used to be called Asperger's, this sort of higher functioning, people call it, end of autism, kind of coming together with a sense of pride about their differences. And, you know, we are what they call neurodiverse. We're different. We have something to offer the world, to the point of some of them being concerned about looking for ways to cure autism, because then we may lose some of this difference, some of this genius in some cases. That is such an interesting area.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking about the mental health issues of some of history's most intriguing figures with science writer Claudia Kalb. She's author of Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder, Inside the Minds of History's Great Personalities. You can join our conversation after the break by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. We're talking today about Albert Einstein and Asperger's, Marilyn Monroe's borderline personality disorder, Lincoln's depression, and Frank Lloyd Wright's narcissism. Claudia Kalb has written a book detailing 12 famous people's mental health struggles. It's called Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder, Inside the Minds of History's Greatest Personalities. So, Claudia, if the famous composer George Gershwin were a kid growing up today, instead of at the turn of the 20th century, you say he would have probably been given a diagnosis and given medicine for what?
Well, that is such an interesting question. You know, Gershwin had this unbounded energy. When he was a kid, he would roam the city streets. He would get into fist fights and brawls. He would roller skate. He would not really be able to sit still in school. He didn't do his homework all the time. He skipped classes. What was going on with him would look today like sort of a classic attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And, you know, I looked into this after hearing this hypothesis from a wonderful psychiatrist who is also trained at Juilliard in piano, named Dr. Richard Cohen, who looks at the minds of composers and was studying Gershwin and said, you know, this is a case where probably he would have been, as a child, sent off to a psychologist, a school counselor, tested for ADHD, and then possibly given Ritalin. And what would that have meant to the rest of his musical career? And would we have had Rhapsody in Blue?
So, of course, while reading the book, I put on Rhapsody in Blue because you mentioned it. And then I couldn't help but notice the energy and the rhythm. So let's listen for a minute. Could a piece of music sort of give you a clue that someone might have ADHD?
Well, if you keep listening to the piece,
yeah.
It gets better. it gets much more abundant with energy. It just comes pouring out. And he played it at times incredibly fast. So you see this sort of energy that he just poured in. And what's so interesting about him is that when he discovered music, he didn't grow up in a musical family. When he discovered music, he said it turned him from a bad boy to a good one. It was a way of his. It was a way for his passion to be channeled. He found his passion. He could put his energy into it, and he was, you know, he was described as sort of this bundle of nervous energy all the time. Even as an adult, he would tap dance when he was waiting for an elevator, and he cracked peanuts during rehearsals. And Kitty Carlisle wrote a reminiscence where he was elbowing her in the ribs during a prize fight they went to together so many times she felt black and blue by the end. He just couldn't sit still. And the music became what he poured it into. And what's interesting about Rhapsody in Blue especially, he wrote that piece. He composed it very quickly. He didn't know he was supposed to be, or he'd forgotten he had committed a piece to a big concert hall concert, and he had only a few weeks, and he had an inkling of an idea, but that piece came rushing to him while he was taking a train from New York to Boston, and he heard the noise of the train, the wheels and the engine, and all of that fed into his plot for the composition. So it's kind of, I mean, there's the energy right there. It came from the noise of life.
And Gershwin, you write that he called Rhapsody in Blue a musical kaleidoscope of America, of our vast melting pot, of our incomparable national pep, our blues, and our metropolitan madness, which...
Well, yeah, I mean, such a great description, such a, just a conglomeration of so many things, and you kind of just hear energy even in that depiction of it.
Yeah, but there are many critics of the label ADHD. Why is it such a controversial diagnosis?
Right, definitely. So I think there's a lot of concern about any kind of diagnosing going on with children. And when you look at ADHD specifically, a lot of those traits and behaviors of energy and restlessness and inattention would appear to be the normalcy of childhood, especially, you know, in younger years where kids, you know, are now being stuck in seats at school and really what they need to do is be running around. And so are we kind of forcing some kind of diagnosis on children who really need more energy? You know, they need to be outside and display their energy in that way. So I think there's a lot of concern that there's overdiagnosis, there's inappropriate diagnosis, there's concern about medicating children. Why are we putting them on drugs to, you know, quote unquote, treat just normal childhood? But I think because these conditions do exist on a continuum, in some cases where there is real trouble and there's hyperactive stuff going on, there's impulsivity, there's inattention, and it's affecting the child so much with friendships and with school, it can lead to things like depression and anxiety and substance use if it's not dealt with. So I think there are a lot of questions about how best to look at it, you know, diagnose it or not, treat it. Lots of questions, but I don't think it's an either-or situation. I think it just has to be every child studied individually and really given thoughtful analysis.
Another diagnosis that's I don't know if it's controversial, but it's definitely newer, is one of narcissism or a narcissistic personality disorder, which is even separate. But you talk about this, about Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect.
Right. Frank Lloyd Wright. He was such an interesting person. You know, he had this aesthetic ideal that was so pure, this organic simplicity that he strove for in these just beautiful buildings and designs. But he really did not treat people very well. He had a lot of sense of superiority, a sense of entitlement. He was very confident. He believed in his vision above all else. And what's so interesting is he designed these extraordinary buildings, and in some cases, you know, the roofs leaked and the floors weren't that great and the ceilings were too low, and there was all stuff going on, just practical concerns that, and you were supposed to essentially be so grateful to be, you know, living in or you know, in a Frank Lloyd Wright house that none of that mattered, so that, you know, the story of the Johnson Wax building, where he built this great office building with these huge tall pillars that went up to the top, but the roof leaked so much that all the workers had buckets on their desk to catch the water.
And the story of his final creation of the Guggenheim Museum in New York City sort of puts this confidence or narcissism perhaps on display. What was the problem with that building?
I know. You know, that's such a great story, because if you've been to the Guggenheim, you enter it and you know it's just all around that wonderful dramatic stairway, the spiral stairway that goes up the museum. But when he was designing it, you know, it was so much about his vision and how it should look that the paintings initially, when he first designed it, the stairway meant everything. And the paintings were going to be slanted so that when you walked up to see them, they could not accommodate a painting at an angle at which a viewer would most want to see it, which is just upright. So there was, you know, his vision was, it's got to look like I want it to look. And it became clear, what are we talking about here? Is this Wright's vision, or is this a place for, you know, is this about the modern art we're going to display? And there were 21 artists wrote a complaint letter saying he has a callous disregard for the works of art.
Which I guess he would say, well, mine's a work of art too, and so, you know, maybe that comes
true
first. But
and ultimately they did straighten those by the way. They, you know, as
they
you
came
know,
up
the,
with
the
a solution.
Yes. Yeah.
So in 1957, when Frank Lloyd Wright was 90 years old, he sat down with an interview with Mike Wallace, and Wallace confronted him about his tendency to brag. Listen to this.
You said many years ago that you would someday be the greatest architect of the 20th century. Have you reached your goal?
Well, now I think I never said it.
Well, I've done a considerable amount of reading by you and about you this week, and I don't think there's a good deal of doubt about the fact that over the years you have said it not once, but many times, and maybe in not that specific form.
You know, I may not have said it, Mike, but I may have felt it.
You do feel it?
But it's so unbecoming to say it that I should have been careful about it.
I love that.
I know, that's great.
That quote. I mean, I know a lot of people who are really self-confident and maybe like to brag. And I mean, this diagnosis of narcissism, how do you put that on someone? It's got to be controversial.
Right. I mean, in that, you know, garden variety narcissism, there's a lot of people who display those traits and they're full of themselves and they talk about themselves and you know who they are and you kind of deal with it. Narcissistic personality disorder would be something more intrinsic, more inflexible, a real sense of entitlement, these characteristics of grandiosity. In Wright's case, really not caring about how much something cost, not having much empathy. Exploiting relationships. He did this professionally and he did it. His personal relationships suffered. You know, he really it was all about him. And I think to the detriment of people around him. So I think it's a difficult diagnosis at some level. And it's difficult, especially in terms of what do you do about it, because it's a classic situation where somebody who has a great narcissistic issue is not exactly running in to find out how to fix himself. He's perfectly happy in most
yeah.
cases. You know, it's everybody else who's rushing off to the psychiatrist saying, "How do I deal with this?" So it is. It's a difficult one. And in his case, it was just so out there. And when you read his own writing, I mean, he often referred to himself in the third person. I mean, there's a million ways in which he just. These traits just came out so strongly with him.
So all of the people that you write about in this book, they're all past, they're dead. Did you think about doing this for famous people who are alive today? Would you dare?
People are doing it, as anybody who's following the election currently would know. But people like to sort of speculate. I felt like, you know, I really wanted to focus on people, yeah, who were no longer alive, in part because the history was there. So, you know, there were letters and journals of Einstein, of Darwin, of some autobiographies that people wrote. There was a sense of perspective and also a history in terms of the condition, how it had evolved. And so there's a way of really putting it all into context. And I think it's the life was finished, so it was over. There was you saw how it played out. I mean, you knew Marilyn Monroe had died suicide, whether she intended it or not, unclear, but that happened. And we know how her life ended, and we know, so we know, you know, it fits the pattern of the condition. So it really, to look at it in depth, you have the whole life story, and you don't really have that with people alive today.
Has anyone reached out? Have you gotten much pushback, either from maybe family of any of the 12 people who you I know you're not giving them actual diagnoses, but who you're saying may have had this or been diagnosed with that. Has anyone protested?
No. I mean, I think, you know, everything that I've written about, really, in most cases, either the person came forward, as in Diana's case, and talked about bulimia. I looked at Betty Ford for addiction, and she herself obviously talked about it and raised public awareness. And in other cases, it was a matter of, it was out there already. And in almost every one of these cases, somebody had speculated in the mental health field about the person. And I was unraveling that and looking at that. So no pushback at all on that end, and really very positive feedback from readers, some of whom are identifying characteristics. Somebody wrote saying she had just gone to therapy for the first time, identifying some issues in herself that she saw in one of the characters and wanting to sort of explore it and figure it out and maybe make her life better. So that, to me, that's the greatest outcome.
Hmm. Now, do you think that looking back, I mean, these people are all from different backgrounds, but they're all, as many celebrities from that time were white people. And do you think that we might see any different mental illnesses if we were looking at different demographics?
Right. And that was something I struggled with, because I would have loved to have had a little more of a variety in terms of racial variety. And one of the issues was just being able to conclusively look at a certain condition. And these were the ones that rose to the top in terms of the evidence and the support in terms of biography and letters and journals and all of that material. I think there are different views on mental health in different racial and ethnic communities that can affect people getting the help they need. And that's a big issue that I hope will change to, you know, so that people can get good care. But these conditions strike across the board. I mean, as you see with Diana, somebody famous and privileged, you know, to people who live in difficult circumstances and may not even be able to identify the characteristics and get help. So it's, I mean, any one of these conditions could affect anyone on the universe. And so it really is, in that sense, universal.
Hmm. Claudia Kalb is author of Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder, Inside the Minds of History's Great Personalities. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you, Lauren. It was wonderful.
And Claudia will also be coming to Dallas on Thursday, May 12th for a luncheon event at the Adolphus Hotel. You can find the details at KERA News. Claudia, have a great day. And Think is produced by Stephen Becker. It's engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help on the phones today from Alex Smith. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact us via email, think@kera.org. Have a wonderful day.